So, good afternoon, everybody. So, now we start, after having spent the whole morning telling you how great and important LHC is for all us particle physicists, now you're going to hear a heretic already. But you will see at the end that he's not quite a heretic. If I know what he's going to talk about, that LHC will have something for him too. So, here is Kevin going to tell us about, he has changed LHC from the sidelines.
Right. So, thank you. So, it's true. I do not work at the LHC. So, you know, if you're the after-lunch speaker, one of your sacred duties is to remember that everybody else, including and you, for that matter, in the room, is going to be suffering from a food coma. So, I'm hoping that I've managed to keep this interesting enough. And where I wanted to start was to offer a possible explanation, which turns out to be incorrect. So, you know, one might reasonably assume that if I'm not working at the LHC, there must be a good reason. And people who know me well know that coffee is something that's very important to me. If you walk into my office, there's a little cathedral to coffee in the center with the machine. And so I snapped this picture while I was in Kyoto a couple of years back. And the thing I want to draw your attention to is this on the menu. So as some of you may know, there's not an exact literal translations of phonemes involving R's and L's into Japanese. And so that katakana character there is something that really is more like what we would say is a ra, but it's more pronounced ra. So it, you know, sort of somewhere between an R and an L. So this is a perfectly understandable mistake. On the other hand, the language I studied was not Japanese when I was a student. It was French. And so when I read this, I immediately looked at it and said, cafe rate? Rate, that means failed coffee. And so I did actually check it out, and in fact, it was an accurate description, as it turned out. So. It's a tea drinking culture, I believe. So yeah, I don't work at the LHC, and I don't do it because I don't care for the coffee in Europe. Actually, some coffee in the CERN cafeteria is quite lovely, it turns out. I do it because particle physics is a broad science that actually has many frontiers. And the one that you've heard about so far today is what I would refer to as the energy frontier. It's going to the highest energies and trying to see what we can make. And the way that we got there turns out to be a very complicated story. Some of it involves previous exploration of frontiers of high energies, but some of it also involves going back and looking at other frontiers in particle physics. So what I would suggest to you is that energy is an important tool, and it's a timely tool right now, but it's certainly not the only tool for doing particle physics. And if we look at a recent, well, I'm going to be cynical and call it a political report. So one of the things that we do in our field is we prioritize how we want to do projects. And one of the ways that the current panel that's in charge of this is looking at things is trying to look at the different frontiers of physics. And this is the front page of a presentation that was just given on this subject. And it actually labels different frontiers. So there's the energy frontier that Ayana talked about at the LHC. There's also the intensity frontier. And that's what I'm actually going to spend most of my talk discussing. And James will be talking about the cosmic frontier in his talk and a lot of the experiments that are at the interface between particle physics and cosmology. But one of the important things to notice is in the diagram, a lot of the questions that we're interested in actually are answered on more than one frontier. In fact, the number of topics that really only belong in one place is maybe not so large. And the number that belong in many places is actually quite substantial. So we're using these complementary tools to get at the same sort of interesting questions. So what do I mean when I say intensity frontier? Well, so the LHC, coming back to what you've already heard about from Ayana, is optimized to give you the maximum energy in the collision of two protons, the maximum energy that you can release into a small number of particles. Now, that amount of energy, you know, in absolute scale, in joules, is not a huge amount of energy. right? But it's contained in two, well, not quite fundamental, but close to fundamental particles, two very small particles. And as we heard, okay, they're not fundamental. What you're actually colliding are the quarks or the gluons inside. But every once in a while, you get a fair fraction of that energy available in order to make new particles or to see the effect of new forces at very high energies. And it turns out that that probability for getting a large fraction of that energy released in a single collision is actually quite rare. And so one of the reasons the LHC has this tremendous amount of stored beam energy is they have to have many collisions of protons on protons in order to get these relatively rare events that really do push at the energy frontier. So the LHC is a very intense machine, but it's intense in a way that's really there to maximize the energy that's available in very small systems, a very small number of particles. There are, of course, other ways to build and design accelerators. And other accelerators don't take this optimization. They instead make a purposeful trade-off, and they say, well, what if I instead make lower energy particles, but I make more of them? And this can be done in either colliding beam experiments of the type that the LHC does, or sometimes you even want to take a single beam and have it interact with a target. We call these sometimes fixed target experiments. Beam interacts with the target to produce some other particles that we're interested in studying. And one of the terms that's, well, it's actually probably fairly old, but it seems like it has been used in droves in the last dozen years or so in talking about projects. We actually call these machines in many cases factories, right? So it's a factory for producing a certain kind of particle. And what it really is are maybe lower energy protons, for example, than we are capable of making at the highest energy machines, at the energy frontier, but more of them. And in fact, if you look at the program in particle physics, it turns out there are an incredible number of energy frontier, intensity frontiers that we've explored in the last several years. Very recently, the last dozen years or so, major efforts both at Stanford and at a Japanese facility were put into what was called the B factory for bottom quarks. And those facilities did very precise studies of something that I'll talk about a little bit later, particle, antiparticle asymmetries. And the tool to do it was just making a lot of Bs and studying their properties. And so that was more important than pushing the frontier of energy for that physics goal. There's a CHARM and Tau factory, one running in upstate New York that's in the process of decommissioning, one still running in China. There was a major program, really the focus of the field in many ways when I was a graduate student and into the time I was a postdoc, was a program at CERN and again also at Stanford where we were making a weak boson factory. Now that's a high energy version of an intensity frontier machine, but the idea was to make large numbers of weak bosons. And it turns out, as I'll show later, that those studies actually led us to where we are today in wanting to run the LHC. So anyway, you get the point. There are many kinds of different particle factories that have been built. What I'll talk the most about, because it's of most interest to me, and I think most interest to the field right now, are making very intense sources of moderate energy protons in order to produce other sorts of particles, and in particular neutrinos. So where is the intensity frontier in this area, if we want to talk about it as a single frontier? Well, it turns out that the highest intensity, at least for this type of business, proton machine is actually at Fermilab at the moment. And it's being used to do two things, to produce antiprotons for the Tevatron Collider, which is, until the LHC turns on, still the energy frontier. But it's also being used to make large numbers of neutrinos that I'll talk about in a little bit. And there's actually a plan for taking this facility, and a plan that is a relatively high priority for our national program, and to try to upgrade that facility to get more and more beam power to, again, recapture the frontier. So I've implied that, in fact, there's going to be a time when we will not have that frontier. That time is coming very soon. There's a facility that's being built on the east coast of Japan called J-Park, and this is a very broad facility to build a number of very intense proton beams at different energies. And one of the key parts of that machine is actually building a neutrino beam for an experiment that I'll describe a little bit later. And it turns out I actually collaborate in both of these areas. Because this one is an ongoing construction project, I thought I'd show some slides to in fact show you it is an ongoing construction project, and lots of happy Japanese people with, you know, 100-some, you know, various goals that they've achieved in their commissioning there. So this is actually a really exciting time for that project as they bring this new machine online. All right. So enough about the facilities and the what. The key, of course, is the science that we try to do there. And as tempting as it was, and believe me, it was very tempting to talk about all the science that's done at the other frontiers of particle physics, I had to make some choices in this talk. And so I'm really going to talk about two things. One of them is to pick up on something that was suggested later, by Raman in his talk, where he talked about the shadows of high-energy phenomena in quantum fluctuations. And so I'll talk a little bit about the kind of physics we do that way. And then my second topic in this area will be neutrinos and what we hope to learn from them. And actually, it turns out, to tell this story, I'm going to be doing hopping back and forth between those two subjects and hopping around in time as well. So I guess that's the buckle your seatbelts warning. All right. So it's worth explaining a little bit about what I mean by quantum fluctuations, because that's not an obviously familiar topic. And we see at the top there the Raman slide on the subject. Obviously, the theorists and experimentalists sort of have different approaches to PowerPoint, probably one of the things that you may notice. So what he explained is that this is all due to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And what the uncertainty principle does is it allows us to study processes that we can't access directly with the energies that are available. So the LHC, remember, collides very high energy beams to put very high energies into very small numbers of particles. The alternate approach would be to use these quantum shadows, these quantum fluctuations, and at lower energies study the same sort of physics. And these two approaches are very complementary historically and have led us to a really deep understanding of the phenomena that we have a good grasp on today in particle physics. So here's an example of such a process. So I was reminded by one of you discussing at one of the coffee breaks that if I show a Feynman diagram, I darn well better explain it. So I'm going to do my level best here. So this is meant to be, and these are unfortunately sort of the currency for particle physicists. It's almost hard for us to speak without a Feynman diagram on every page. So I'm doing my best so far, but I had to break down by the time I got to this point. So what this shows is a W boson, a carrier of the weak force. And there's a vertex here. There's probably a pointer here, too, somewhere. There's a vertex here where the W, so think about reading in time this way in this diagram. The W turns into a top quark and an anti-bottom quark, okay, and then recombines to form a W. All right, so that's how you can think of this process. And it's just a visual way of representing the process. Now, the W fluctuating into top and anti-bottom quark is fine, except, however, the mass of this W boson is actually less than the mass of the top quark. So if we think about the E equals M squared equals MC squared energy involved, you know, if I cut this off at this point and said the W turns into a top and an anti-bottom quark forever, that would violate conservation of energy because this thing requires more energy than is available. Okay. So how can such a thing happen? And more importantly, I think, is it actually real, right? Or is this a figment that doesn't really have any significance? Well, it certainly happens. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle tells us that if you want to think of it as an uncertainty in energy times an uncertainty in time is bounded. Okay, there has to be, the product of those two uncertainties has a certain minimum value. Okay? And there's lots of ways to think about this. The way I guess I'd like to think about it is that it allows us to borrow things that we don't have from the vacuum as long as we pay them back in a short amount of time. So I can borrow energy, and I just have to remember to give it back very quickly. And this is a very small number. So when I say very quickly, I mean very, very quickly. So a way of thinking about this is that it takes time to measure that energy. So you don't actually know that you violated conservation of energy unless you wait a certain amount of time to make the measurement. Okay. And that might seem like a bit of a game, but I ran into this Dilbert cartoon, and it actually, as somebody who's currently involved in building an experiment, there's a lot of truth in this. What Dilbert is saying is the project uncertainty principle says that if you understand what you're doing, you have no idea how much it costs. And you know, that actually, if you think about it, that's kind of correct, right? You can either spend your time understanding, or you can worry about every penny that's going out the door as you build something. And so it's a similar thing. You can borrow a little bit of money in order to make some understanding. You just really do have to pay it back later, right? All right. So we can borrow energy from the vacuum for a short time. So that's what's going on. We have borrowed the energy to make the top quark, but then it has to be returned back to the original W boson. Right. So is it real? Yes, it's real. And in fact, what this sort of a process does is it actually makes a quantum correction that you can measure. It changes a measurable quantity. And in particular, what this diagram is changing is the mass of the W boson. So if you go and you predict its mass from the theory, neglecting this kind of a process, and you measure it, you will not get the answer you predicted unless you include these sort of quantum fluctuations in the mix. So it is absolutely real, even though you've borrowed the process from the vacuum, if you like. All right, so let's calculate a quantum fluctuation. And I'm doing this to illustrate some features, not to do a detailed calculation. So apologies to the cognoscenti who know this is not a detailed calculation. So the process I want to look at is a neutrino scattering off of a neutron to create an electron and a proton. All right. So here's a diagrammatic way of representing that. The neutrino comes in, the neutron is coming in, these are the outgoing particles. All right. And that's a relatively a common and useful process for a variety of reasons. So how do we think that that process actually takes place? Well, you can blow apart what's going on at this vertex and look at it more carefully, and you would come up with this analysis of the process. This is the most common way that this reaction happens. It happens because there's an exchange of a weak force carrier, the W boson, between the neutrino and the neutron, changing the final state into the electron and the proton. Okay. Now, at energies where you typically want to look at this reaction, where this reaction is interesting, you might only have a few GeV or a few MeV of energy to produce the W. But the W itself has a mass of 80 GeV. So there is no way that this W can be radiated off and exist forever in this process. It has to be the energy to produce it has to be borrowed. All right, so how much energy do we have to borrow? Well, if we didn't start with much and we need 80 GeV, we have to borrow the 80 GeV, the whole thing, okay, more or less. So here's the uncertainty principle, and here's what this constant is, a very small number, and I've expressed it in gigaelectron volts times seconds. We have to borrow 80 GeV, so that means we have to return it back in 4 times 10 to the minus 27 seconds, or we get in trouble. Well, or it doesn't happen. Okay, well, let's ask another question. If I'm a W boson and I have to be returned to from whence I came in 10 to the minus 27 seconds, how far can I travel? Well, the fastest I can travel is the speed of light, right? And so I can go something like 10 to the minus 18 meters. So if we think about this process, you've got a neutrino coming in, all right? So here's my arrow. And what I want to do in order to make this process happen, what I'm actually doing is scattering off of a quark inside the neutron, and I'm changing it to a different type of quark in order to make a proton. That quark is, as far as we know, a point particle. It has no size. Okay. So in order to make this happen, I have to get very, very, very close to that quark. I have to get 10 to the minus 18 meters close to that quark. So I was talking with one of you at the reception last evening, and we were talking about the little lies that you have to tell in order to simplify things. And I said that when I got to the little lies, I would give a signal. I would start raising up my right elbow. This isn't a very good model for what's actually going on if you want to calculate something. All right. But anyway, forging bravely ahead. So that's about 1/1000th of a proton radius. And so if you think about this in terms of target area, relative target area, this says that the interaction of the neutrino should be maybe 1/1000000th as likely as if you had, say, a proton scattering off of that neutron and you wanted to see some reaction take place. Okay. Well, am I even close to right here? No. I do have the right direction. It certainly is a much rarer process. But I, this whole model is rote, shall we say. Right? It's not really a representation that gets all the details right in any sense. But in a very qualitative sense, it does capture some of the key features that are here. And the key features that I really want to emphasize are that these quantum fluctuations are rare. So when you need a quantum fluctuation, you've made a process rare. You've made it very uncommon. And the more energy you have to borrow, if you like, the smaller this target would have become, and the more rare the process would be. So the more energy you have to borrow, the farther you are away from producing the reality of the thing that you want to study in the vacuum, the rarer the process becomes. And then the other thing is that thinking about weak interactions in general, usually when we study them in the lab, or many times when we study them in the lab, we're in this state where we have to borrow energy in order to make weak interactions. So when we talk about why the weak force is weak, it's weak because it's a quantum fluctuation. Of course, it happens at all because it's a quantum fluctuation, but that is actually what gives the weak force its well-deserved name. All right. So it turns out we've studied as a field quantum fluctuations of weak bosons ad nauseum. When I was a when I was a graduate student, one could not go to a particle physics conference without actually seeing some variant of this plot at least twice, maybe five times. And what this is meant to be is a summary of measurements that probe quantum fluctuations of weak bosons and of their processes. And there's no point in me trying to describe what all these measurements are, but it's a broad physics program that was done using these very large numbers of weak bosons that were produced at an intensity frontier factory for weak bosons. It's a high energy intensity frontier, but it was nevertheless made aimed at the goal of producing many particles very cleanly that you could study, in particular Z bosons. Okay. And so we had this catalog of precision measurements probing these quantum fluctuations. So what did we learn from that? Well, we actually learned quite a bit, and things that are informing us today. So Ayanna was asked at the end of her talk, well, do you know what the mass of the Higgs boson is? We sort of do, not maybe exactly, if we believe that the theory is in its simplest form, or if we believe the theory, we can predict what the mass of the Higgs boson should be. And that constraint actually comes about from this type of process. So in this one, a W or a Z boson is spending some of its time splitting it into a W or Z boson with a Higgs loop. Or here's one where the Higgs loop is complete and detached. Okay, these are quantum fluctuations involving the Higgs boson and these W and Z bosons that we produced at the intensity frontier. And from measuring these quantum corrections, remember that the amount, the size of these corrections depends on how much energy you have to borrow to produce that Higgs. Okay? That energy that you have to borrow has to do with its mass. And so we're able to constrain the mass of the Higgs boson. And so what's shown here is something you can think of as a probability type of plot. The most probable mass for the Higgs boson would be where this blue band is the lowest, and it becomes less probable as the blue band goes up. Here are direct searches excluded in yellow, and here's kind of this narrow region in here where we think we might have a good shot at finding the Higgs boson. Now, you know, it might be a little higher. This isn't a very severe constraint, a very strong constraint, but it does give us an idea about where we want to be looking. And by the way, tell us what energy we should be building the LHC at, right? Okay, so I want to leave the world of quantum fluctuations for a minute and talk about where I do most of my work these days, which is in a difficult corner of the known building blocks, looking at particles called neutrinos. And neutrinos are difficult simply because their only interaction is weak. This isn't the first mention you've had of neutrinos. Ayana also talked about neutrinos. And actually, she went through this particular example. She looked at beta decay processes. And if you think about it, beta decay is just the emission of a single particle from a nucleus undergoing a transition in atomic number. This process starts with one thing. It has two things in the final state. And so you should expect a definite energy of this particle leaving the interaction. But if you actually look, you see some sort of a continuous spectrum, not a single energy. And so when this was noted, one of the ideas was that, well, maybe there's another light particle that we don't see interacting that is taking away this energy. And Wolfgang Pauli proposed this in 1930, and he said it was part of, he gave it the name neutron, actually. It turned out that name kind of got appropriated for other purposes later. He called it a neutron and said it was a light particle that could take away the energy and thus explain how energy could be conserved in this kind of reaction. Now later, after the name got stolen, Fermi suggested maybe we'll call it the little neutron, Italian neutrino, right? So. Okay, so, all right, if neutrinos are only about nuclear beta decay, this probably should be a very short talk. All right. Because if you think about beta decay in the context of the way our universe is made up today, it's arguably not the most important force a priori. And in particular, if you look at the other fundamental forces besides the weak nuclear force, gravity, well, that holds planets and galaxies together. That sounds kind of important. Right? Electromagnetism, well, that's what holds atoms together. And the strong, oh, and just incidentally, keeps matter from collapsing under the influence of gravity. That's a good thing, too, while we're at it. And the strong force is the thing that binds the nucleus together and confines all the quarks in this very central small core. So these are the interactions that really give us the structure of matter. And then there's the weak nuclear force that helps out with beta decay. Yeah, that sounds awfully anticlimactic if I put it that way, doesn't it? Well, it turns out we all care a great deal about the weak nuclear force, because the weak nuclear force does a lot of things for us. One thing it does in the sun gets its energy by burning hydrogen, by fusing protons together. And in order to put two protons together, you can't make a stable state just putting two protons together. You actually have to take one of these protons and turn it into a neutron. That's exactly the opposite process of beta decay, as it turns out. And you can't do that without emitting some of this extra energy in the form of neutrinos. So, if we didn't have the weak nuclear force, we'd be where the sun don't shine, so to speak. Right? Ba-dum-boom. Sorry. Try to cut down the corny jokes. All right, so, but that actually leads to a more general point. And you've seen this picture also before. And if we think about the matter that matters, right, the stuff that's around us every day, well, we have up and down quarks that make up most of the nuclei in the atoms around us. They bind with electrons to make atoms. And, of course, now I've convinced you the neutrino had better be there or we're in some trouble. Right? But you only need one of those. Okay? So here's what we need: up, down quarks, electrons, a neutrino. But if we look in nature, there's actually three copies of each of these things. And the thing that distinguishes these three copies are that they have different masses. Otherwise, they're just copies. Okay? And we don't see these in ordinary matter, typically. All right. So that creates a little problem. And to explain the little problem it creates, so we're thinking about things that you can take away to your students. So this is something, this is a couple slides that are the basis of a talk that I've given to students, high school students, going into classrooms. And the purpose of the lecture is to explain what the Big Bang is. Okay. So these have been field tested. They have easy demonstrations. If your students don't know what the Big Bang is, you could try it out, see if it works for you. So in the beginning, okay, maybe lose the loaded word at the start. In the beginning, the universe was very small and it was very hot. Okay. Well, how do we know that? We know that because We know it was very small because if we look at everything around us, it's moving away from us. Okay? And it's not something we said. It's that the universe is expanding everywhere. Okay? So if you think a nice analogy that I've heard, if you think about a loaf of raisin bread rising as it's baked, right? All the raisins are moving away from all the other raisins in that bread. The raisins are not special just because everything is moving away from them. It's just that the bread is expanding. Okay. So the evidence that all the other galaxies are moving away from us doesn't make us special. It just means we're in an expanding space. And we know it's expanding because of the Doppler effect. It's pretty easy to demonstrate the Doppler effect. And in this case, it's the Doppler effect of light that tells us that it's expanding. So I said it was very small, and I said why, but very hot. And why hot? So typically the way I demonstrate this, depending on what I have available, is to let some gas expand in an uncontrolled way. So, you know, you can buy a little nitrogen propellant thing and use that. You can actually get it if you just inflate a high-pressure bike tire and you put your finger on the nozzle. It gets awfully cold by the time it's deflated. Very easy thing to demonstrate and show your students. So as it expands, it cools. Therefore, it must have started in a hotter place. So there's the universe in a nutshell. Now, for our purposes, remember that mass is energy and heat is energy. Okay? So heat gives you the ability to make massive things in the early universe. So very early in the universe, it was so hot that all these masses of the different generations didn't matter. And you just produced particles from the different generations, and that was fine. But as the universe cools, suddenly these generational mass differences are big compared to the temperature of the universe. And you have to get rid of these. We don't see them around today. So how does that happen? Turns out it happens by beta decay. Okay. So the way that the heavy generations decay into the light generations and aren't around for us to see today turns out to be exactly the process of beta decay. So neutrinos make the sun shine, but they also make the universe the way they are today. All right. So one more thing about the early universe before I move on and switch away from neutrinos for a little interlude. So every fundamental particle has an antimatter partner, right? So there's sort of a symmetry between the two, if you like. If there's an up quark, you have an anti-up anti-quark or up anti-quark or whatever you want to call it. When those two particles meet, they can annihilate into some form of energy, like a force carrier, for example, a gluon. And that energy can turn itself into matter plus antimatter. So here's a process that we use at the Fermilab Tevatron in order to produce top quarks and discover them. An up quark and an anti-up quark annihilate to produce a top quark and an anti-top quark. In the early universe, this is happening fluidly. There's a lot of energy, a lot of heat. Right? So you can produce heavy states, and they can annihilate back to energy. Well, if the story of the early universe is that you were producing matter and antimatter, and then it was annihilating back into energy, right? And you produced lots of matter and antimatter, where did the antimatter go? It's not... Boy, there's a little slip of the tongue, huh? Anyway, it's not visible in the universe... Nor is it visible in the university or would be in some serious trouble. It's not visible in either place today. Annihilations are pretty hard to miss, right? There's a tremendous amount of energy released. So if you had a matter and an antimatter galaxy colliding, you would notice, right? It would be a very easy event to see, even if it weren't our galaxy, even if it were far away. And we see nothing like this in the universe, okay? So there's the problem of not seeing a lot of antimatter out there, but there's another problem. Where did the, you know, leftover matter, right? Where did all that come from? How did that get left behind? Because remember, we produced matter-antimatter pairs. Why is there leftover matter that we see around today? Okay, so that brings us back to a story at the intensity frontier. So one of the things that we can also do at the intensity frontier is to look for rare violations of symmetries. So symmetries are things like the symmetry between particles and antiparticles, saying that they should have similar properties. And physicists like to use a jargon calling it CP symmetry. Okay. that tells you, for example, that part of matter and antimatter, if it's unstable, should have identical decay rates by CP symmetry. But it turns out, if you look at the intensity frontier, CP is not a symmetry of nature. It's violated not much, but it is violated. So matter and antimatter decay differently. This was first observed actually a long time ago, before I was born, as it turned out. In a particle called a kaon. And the way it was observed was by making a lot of kaons and looking for an uncommon decay of the kaon. If we look back on that discovery today, it was actually tremendously significant, not just because it told us there was a difference between matter and antimatter, but it turns out that in order to explain this, okay, here's another Feynman diagram I have to explain. So here's a representation of a neutral anti-kaon. Okay? So that's a strange quark and an anti-down quark. And what it's doing is it's fluctuating quantum mechanically into a W boson, each of these quarks, into a W boson and some sort of an anti-quark here. Here the strange absorbs that W boson, changes into a different kind of quark, and then it happens again. You get a box diagram, as this is called, for obvious reasons. And at the end, it's a neutral kaon. So it's matter changing into antimatter. What's significant about this is that it turns out in order to get this difference between matter and antimatter generated by this type of process, you can actually show that you need all three generations of matter to be present. If you didn't have the lightest, the medium, and the third generation, you wouldn't get this difference between matter and antimatter behavior. So it requires us to have three generations. So we don't know why we have three generations, but we know it's important to have three generations. So to recap, the universe has a lot more matter than antimatter, which requires matter and antimatter to somehow behave differently. And we've found a difference between them in this neutral kaon and in other particles. This is why we built the B factories. And this has led to a broad program of investigation, including these sorts of things, at the intensity frontier. And the conclusion of those investigations about matter-antimatter asymmetry involving quarks is that the amount of matter-antimatter asymmetry involving quarks can't actually explain the amount of left-behind matter that we have in the universe today. But that's exploration, right? Sometimes things happen like that. So we still have an interesting puzzle to deal with. What sorts of things are we interested in doing that are like this, are rare processes? One thing that we're very interested in is the idea that there might be transitions between generations of matter that don't involve neutrinos. So here's an example of such a process, and it's a fantasy Feynman diagram now. Okay? So I've drawn it with question marks labeling the particles. We don't know of any particle that could take a muon exchanging an electromagnetic interaction with the nucleus and change it into an electron. But this turns out, for technical reasons, to be something that we could actually measure very well. We could do experiments, well, with a lot of work, we could do experiments that could get us to the point of being able to wait the equivalent of 10,000 years for this rare thing to happen. To do that requires a lot of muons, because the muon lives about 2 microseconds. Okay? So this truly is an experiment involving an intense number of muons. And there are a lot of reasons to think, in fact, that such things might be out there. They might be connected, in fact, to supersymmetry, for example. It might help explain other problems. It's also possible, whatever these things might be, if we find them, that, in fact, they might help us understand something about the mechanics of the different generations and why they're there. But that's kind of crazy speculation, so I'll leave that aside. But this is the kind of thing that people are thinking about doing at this new facility at Fermilab and at this new facility at Japan, in Japan. All right, so back to neutrinos. And I'll explain why in a little bit. So if we want to make neutrinos, we have to think about how to do that. If we want to make neutrinos, we need to involve weak interactions, because that's how we got neutrinos in the first place, beta decay. Well, they're in the early universe. We know that because it's the weak interactions that get rid of all the extra generations. So in fact, there's a waste trail of neutrinos left behind by the Big Bang that actually permeates space, something like 100 per generation per cubic centimeter around us. And for the first time very recently, there's been a cosmological measurement that says that those neutrinos actually have a significant part of the mass of the universe, as much as the atoms do, according to the latest results that just came out. And I have to admit, I haven't had quite a chance to puzzle over, because that seems a little large to me. But are you talking about that, James? A little bit. Okay. Well, neutrinos are also made in the sun, otherwise the sun don't shine, right? And so fusion processes produce neutrinos, and there's actually 100 billion neutrinos per square centimeter per second going through us from the sun. That's a lot of neutrinos. In other processes involving stars, well, supernova 1987A, which was a very large distance away, 150,000 light years, exploded, and it released 100 times the energy in neutrinos that the sun emits in its entire lifetime. And we found 11 on Earth, right? Showing us that neutrinos do play a big role in supernova physics. It was a very important discovery. So, say, is anyone hungry? Hey, John, you look a little hungry. You want a banana? Thanks. I always bring food to talks, lectures, talks. Oh, what do you know? Bananas. Who knew? Neutrinos are found in bananas. Yeah, well, good. I didn't get to make the corny joke. I'll repeat it, though. That's appealing. All right, anyway. So, we each contain about 20 milligrams of potassium-40. Bananas, of course, are an excellent source of potassium. That's an unstable nucleus that undergoes beta decay. So it turns out each of us emits something like 7,500 neutrinos per second from our potassium-40. You didn't know you were a source of neutrinos, but you're an excellent source of neutrinos, it turns out. Write the FDA now. And for the same reason, the radioactivity of the Earth actually results in something like 10 million neutrinos per second being emitted from the Earth. Unfortunately, none of these sources of neutrinos, as excellent as they are so great for studying the kinds of things we want to do. So we look to a different part of nature to understand how to do this. Cosmic rays, high-energy protons that come from outside our galaxy, interact in the atmosphere, produce a shower of unstable particles that decay weakly and produce neutrinos. Thank you. And this is actually how we make neutrinos at Frontier Accelerators. All right. So I have one more part of this story I want to tell, and not so much time to tell it in, so I'll skip some details if you don't mind. The process that we're probing is something called neutrino flavor oscillation. So to explain what that is, I have to explain what flavor is. So flavor is really a code word, if you like, for generations. So remember that neutrinos were discovered in reactions like this, in things involving beta decay. And this positron, it turns out, contains some information. So there are different kinds of neutrinos, some of which, when they interact, produce electrons or positrons, some of which produce muons, some of which produce taus, three generations of neutrinos shown here. Now, if there are three generations, there are also three masses of neutrinos. But an interesting question is whether the neutrino masses are the same as the neutrino generations. And it turns out that we could actually just be looking at a bunch of neutrino puree when we try to measure a neutrino of a certain mass. It could have many different types of flavors associated with it. All right. So if it's neutrino puree, there's an interesting thing that happens. And a fun physical demonstration, which I couldn't quite get on the airplane, so I passed on, involves looking at a coupled pendulum experiment. So as you know, if you've ever done this experiment for your students, there are two normal modes with different frequencies, one of which is like this and one of which is like this. And if you have a weak enough coupling between those two pendulums and you start one of them moving, the motion gradually transfers all to the second one, and then it goes back to the first one. It's a nice experiment to do. It turns out that neutrino flavor oscillation is very analogous to this kind of physical system. The neutrinos are actually changing their flavor, going from one flavor to another, and then back, just in the way the motion is going from one of the pendula to the other and back. So, what we're trying to do in neutrino oscillations is trying to show that neutrinos cause a large matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe, since we didn't find it in the quarks. And because there are three neutrinos, three generations, it could be so. And to do that, we need a new range of intensity frontier accelerators. So I don't have a lot of time to tell you about this. Maybe just make a comment that a big part of both of these facilities I showed you in Japan and at Fermilab would be dedicated towards producing neutrinos, but there's another ingredient. Neutrinos interact so rarely that it's not enough just to make the most intense beams we can manage. We also have to make enormous detectors. And one of the scales that gets thrown around in very unfortunate term is the megaton detector, a million ton detector, okay, made out of, for example, water. So a megaton of water is 100 meter cube on a side. That's a big neutrino detector. And we might have to build something like that in order to get to this physics goal at the end. Where might we build such a thing? Well, there's a new facility that the NSF is proposing to construct called the Deep Underground Science Lab. And it's to be located in beautiful Leeds, South Dakota, as it turns out, in the Black Hills. Don't knock it unless you've been there. It's an interesting place. Maybe not quite the winter climate that you get here, but still. And this actually turns out to be a facility that's built in an existing gold mine with quite an illustrious history. You know, you can dig out lots of black and white photos of the web. Of course, the gold that has been found recently is not the literal Black Hills Gold Rush kind of gold. It turns out neutrinos have been mined here in the recent past. This was the way that we learned that neutrinos were emitted from the sun in an experiment involving, unbelievably enough, 600 tons of dry cleaning fluid. Okay. And looking for the changes of single atoms in that dry cleaning fluid due to the neutrinos. And now we want to send a neutrino beam there at higher energies with different detector technology to see many more. And also, this same facility can host detectors for dark matter that you'll hear about in the next talk. So a new kind of gold in South Dakota. And this is the kind of measurement that we might one day hope to make. So what's shown here is, what's shown here is complicated. It's a probability for neutrinos changing their flavor, and it's different contributions of that probability shown. So this direction is increasing energy of neutrinos, which is the inverse of increasing oscillation time. And so you can see these oscillations as the neutrinos propagate in time. And what's very interesting is to look for this matter-antimatter asymmetry effect that's shown here in the green. And so you see if you measure across a wide range of energies, you can actually see the effect of this rather substantial contribution, if we're lucky. And that's the kind of thing that we would hope to measure. Basically, neutrino flavor transitions as a function of energy, or in other words, how long relativistically the neutrinos have had to oscillate. So let me wrap up. So the LHC is no doubt our flagship, but particle physics does have many frontiers under exploration. There's an interaction between the different frontiers. Sometimes they go after the same science, sometimes one informs the other. And certainly our plans for the LHC were informed by what happened at the intensity frontier in the past. And certainly we can access phenomena that you can't at the LHC. Now this is a lot riskier. The LHC is something that we know is a good bet because of the work that we've done at the intensity frontier. We're almost completely sure that we will see interesting things there. We have very solid arguments. So this is riskier. But, you know, if you invest your retirement in the stock market or bond market, sometimes you buy bonds, sometimes you buy stocks in Brazil, sometimes you buy a house. So once in a while, you take some risks as part of your portfolio. And if I'm on the sidelines of the LHC, what do I expect to see? Thanks. Just happy my voice held out.
The question I have is, the yes. Neutrino oscillation, is that a consistent changeover? I mean, is it, when I go from one neutrino to the next neutrino, as it cycles through like coupled pendulums, does it go through a systematic periodicity, or is it something that's
right
based on other things?
It has a definite periodicity, okay, dealing with how long the neutrino has had since its point of production. The one thing that's true is that it need not be a complete oscillation. So imagine you had a beam of neutrinos. So some could change, some fraction of that beam could change flavor while the others remain intact. In fact, the plot that I showed you at the end, if I remember correctly, has a probability of a flavor oscillation, and you see that that's actually quite low,
right?
Peaking at something like 5% out here. So it can be a relatively rare oscillation, but still goes through this cyclical behavior. And what's actually being shown here, this red line, is a second frequency that's contributing, as it turns out. And it's the interference between these two frequencies that actually gives you the CP violation that you're interested in looking
at. I see.
At.
Thanks.
So it's a complicated picture with three neutrinos.
How similar is that detector that you were commenting on that we were going to build, like in the Dakotas or whatever, similar to the detector that they build under Lake Erie for proton decay?
Let's see. Under Lake Erie, I know of one on the shores of Lake Erie salt mine.
A salt mine, yeah.
Yeah, very similar detector technology. In fact, it really inherits a lot. So that was a detector called IMB, and that detector and the Kamiokande series of detectors in Japan really have been an evolution towards increasingly larger detectors, increasingly sophisticated water detectors that get their measurements from something called Cherenkov light that I don't have time to explain. But it's been an evolving thing. Now there's another idea that's out there that we might try a riskier kind of technology for this very big detector. That involves building something called a time projection chamber out of a liquid noble gas. So it's a much more challenging kind of thing. And people are looking now at ways to prototype that and see if it's realistic. You could, in principle, make such a detector smaller, which is why it might be of interest. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's another important part of the story. Yeah, I'm going to put you off because that's a complicated story that we don't know a lot about. One of the reasons is that when neutrinos slow down, if you like, when they get cold, we don't have a very good way to detect them. So looking at the idea of a right-handed neutrino is something that we go about with a different type of technology, and that was one of those topics that I kind of pushed off to the side as being more than I could do in this talk. But yeah, that's also a very important part of the neutrino program, is looking at the relationship between the neutrino and the antineutrino, is related to your question.
Sorry. Yeah, we live up in the Cascades up by Seattle, and one of the proposed places for diesel was located somewhere close to where we live. One of the things that I understood was that one of the qualifications for catching neutrinos is granitic rock and at some sort of depth. And I know they believe that's also the same within lead. What is the characteristic of the rock that you have to shield your instrument in that makes granitic rock such, you know, so much a better place?
So I didn't I didn't go into this in detail. It turns out that probably for neutrino physics, because we use very intense pulsed beams, pulsed in time beams of neutrinos, you almost could get away with building the detector on the surface, it turns out. So the shielding that you get at Dussel is important for other physics. Now, the reason you might be interested, though, in building this big detector in a deep underground mine is that one of the other things you can do with it is look for another symmetry, look for the decay of the proton. We know that has to be pretty stable. That has to be a very rare process. But if we see it, again, this is one of these benchmark things that could tell us a lot about theories beyond what we know now if we were able to observe proton decay. That needs the big overburden of rock to avoid cosmic rays. As far as the details of the geology, I throw up my hand, and I'm afraid I can't help you with that. So, sorry. But it's not so much for neutrinos that you need it as wanting to do other things with the same detector. That's really important.
Two questions. One, does double beta decay have any context in the areas of your research? And secondly, you know, like the carbon tetrafluoride in the Homestead mine versus just a big volume.
Yeah, it was perchloroethylene.
The tetrachloride versus plain water. What are the tetrachloride? You're changing potassium to argon. What's going on in the water?
So. I'm again, for the same reason I didn't answer it before, I'm going to punt on the double beta decay question, because that's a lengthy story, and I'm not sure I can get into it in any depth. As far as the detection techniques, yeah, these are fundamentally different techniques. The chlorine detector is looking for a single chlorine atom transforming into an argon atom. Okay, and if you think about it, argon being a noble gas is a relatively easy thing to get out of a bulk liquid. So they do something that's the equivalent of sort of shaking up the atoms. They can shake loose this argon. It's radioactive argon, so they can capture it and look for it. But they're pulling single atoms out of 635 tons. So that's technically challenging, shall we say. The water detector is using a completely different technique. What they're doing there is they're actually looking in real time at the recoil particles from the neutrino interaction. Those particles, they aren't going faster than the speed of light, but they go faster than the speed of light in water. And so they make the equivalent of a bow shock, and it's an optical bow shock. So you can actually see the light. So you surround a big tank of detector of water, with photosensitive detectors that are very low noise, something they call a photomultiplier tube. You need a lot of active area, these photomultiplier tubes, for such a big container. But that's the fundamental way that you make that detector big. And it's interesting, if you can keep the water pure and transparent, you know, if you think about it, you only have to instrument the surface of such a tank. So you can make this thing much bigger, right? And you gain volume as the cube, but your area that you have to cover only goes as the square as the size. You know, of course, it's more complicated than that, but there's some reasons to think that might be a winning scaling up of the technology.
I was wondering, how do you control these beams or pulses of neutrinos?
Yeah. How do you control a beam of neutrinos? Yeah, pretty much what you do is this. That's a great question, and it's really hard, and you can't really do it. So when you produce neutrinos in cosmic rays, so the high-energy proton is hitting something in the atmosphere. It's producing these unstable particles that decay into neutrinos. The best you can do is to take these particles. These are mostly things called pions, which I've put in an impossible color because I didn't want to talk about them. But anyway, these pions, and you can electromagnetically focus them. Okay, so you can focus the pions and point them at your detector. But as this diagram shows, the neutrinos don't go exactly along the line of the pions. So as soon as the pion decays, your neutrino beam, with nothing you can do about it, just starts diverging.
Shotgun.
Right, it's a shotgun, exactly. And it's worse than that, because the physics tells you that you have to wait, you have to be patient, you have to wait a certain amount of time for the neutrinos to oscillate. Okay, waiting a certain amount of time means going a certain distance away. So one of the things I didn't get a chance to talk about, but I'll just show diagrammatically, these experiments that you do, you're taking a beam of neutrinos and shooting it all the way across Japan, which, okay, isn't such a big country, but it's still hundreds of kilometers. Meanwhile, the beam is diverging the whole time. So you're bathing the whole area around the detector in this precious beam because you don't have any choice. That's how it is. So, if somebody figures out how to steer a neutrino beam, boy, do you have a future in this field, let me tell you. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, this is the Minos detector, and there's a proposed future detector to go on a site nearby also. But this takes a beam from Fermilab and sends it to northern Minnesota. So that's 735 kilometers, if I remember correctly. So. This mine facility, if you ever get up here and can stand the black flies and the mosquitoes, is really an interesting tour. I would highly recommend it. It's got some old mine history, and then there's this particle physics lab at the bottom of it. So, interesting place.
At the very outset, when you talked about the W particles borrowing energy from the vacuum, is that considered to be a complete vacuum, or is it considered to have like gravitational energy or any kind of energy in it?
Right. So, well. That was part of the point of Raman's talk also, right, that the vacuum is a complicated place. So there's some of what you say that's an interpretation question. I'm choosing to take an interpretation of this, that the vacuum is a simple place and the particle is coming from the vacuum and not particularly affected by what's going on. But the idea that the vacuum is a place where you can borrow energy, you know, tells you that there is some structure to it. And in fact, the fact that this top moves slowly through the vacuum, if you like, related to its mass being high, tells you that the vacuum is very complicated indeed. So that's not maybe the most satisfying or direct answer, but it's...
Okay, so I think we can bring this interesting discussion to a stop. And let's thank everyone.